Hey all, Doug Blair here. What you're about to hear is a special bonus episode of the Daily Signal podcast from our time at the Turning Point USA Student Action Summit. On today's episode, we hear from Josh Hammer, opinion editor and host of the debate podcast for Newsweek. He joins us to discuss how Americans can find the middle ground in an increasingly divided society. This interview was recorded live at the Turning Point USA Student Action Summit, so please pardon any excess noise. We are joined today on the Daily Signal podcast by Josh Hammer. He is the opinion editor and host of the debate podcast for Newsweek, a research fellow at the Edmund Burke Foundation, as well as counsel and policy advisor for the Internet Accountability Project. Josh, thanks so much for joining the show.
Happy to do it anytime.
Excellent. So, let's start out with your work with Newsweek. You write on a wide variety of conservative topics, strongly conservative in your perspective when you write, but you also co-host a podcast called The Debate, where you host debates between politically disparate people, and you attempt to find a middle ground where people start to find they agree. Where did the idea for this podcast first come from, and how do you navigate these discussions in a very politically divided landscape?
So it's tough. So I took over the Newsweek opinion editor job a little over a year ago, May 1st, 2020. It was kind of during COVID, lockdowns, all that. But when I first interviewed for the position a few months prior to that, they kind of told me about this debate idea. At that point, it was purely just an idea. They had like a bare bones skeleton on the website. There was certainly no podcast yet. The idea here is that no one in the mainstream media, Newsweek is nothing if not a mainstream brand, is that no one is actually hosting civil discussions. Literally, no one is doing that. I mean, in the mainstream media, there's no one, obviously, outside of the New York Post and the Wall Street Journal to begin with, yeah, who will even consider publishing, you know, someone right of center or conservative for the most part these days. And then everyone else is monolithically, singularly liberal. So Newsweek's idea here is that we are going to be the home for those discussions. And we're not going to shy away from the dicey issues. We're going to talk about reparations for slavery, critical race theory, qualified immunity, defund the police, whatever. We will not avoid the hard-charging stuff here. So the podcast itself launched in April. I am a conservative. My podcast co-host, Badyang Gursagat, she is obviously liberal. She's an anti-woke liberal. She's a little bit more of a classical liberal. She hates the new woke stuff. But the idea here is that we don't do a whole lot of opining on that podcast itself. We moderate the discussion. We take in the direction we want to take it. I'm obviously like the right of center host. She's the left of center host. But we really want this to be about the guests. And we encourage them to have a civil, robust exchange of ideas. And, you know, this podcast has been out for 3 months. We're getting a lot of downloads. So we think at Newsweek that we've tapped into something, and we'll see where it goes, but we're happy with it.
No, I think it's phenomenal to really have a forum where people can come to the center and discuss these topics that are very important, because, I mean, as a country, you can't really survive if only one side gets to talk and the other side gets sort of pushed down. So I think it's wonderful that people get to talk. I was reading a piece that you wrote for Newsweek titled "The Toxicity of Permanent Outrage Mentality," and something that really struck me in that piece was this phrase that you wrote: "The unfortunate reality is that in our modern political and media ecosystem, a permanently aggrieved, outraged, victimized mentality pays well." So, specifically looking at the media, what do you view as their role in fostering the divided society that we're kind of in now, and where do we go from here? What do we do about it?
Stoking outrage has literally become a business model. You know, it's funny. We see this most acutely actually in social media and in the big tech platforms. There's been a lot of investigative work that have actually shown that Facebook in particular, other of the big tech giants as well, but Facebook in particular, they will literally kind of manipulate their algorithm to kind of put content in your feed that is designed to kind of rile you up. The point of this, obviously, is that riling up, it's not healthy for blood pressure or anything like that, but it does keep people engaged because anger, frustration, these are strong, visceral human emotions. And look, in social media, you know, when we're tweeting out, I mean, it is very easy to then just like react to something and then just get angry and immediately say that some anodyne, not particularly troublesome incident that happened halfway across the country, oh, it's the latest instance of racism, white supremacy, heteronormativity, whatever. It's very easy to extrapolate these one-off incidents and make it fit into like a broader paradigm. And because humans, we always want to feel like we're fighting the next big cause. You know, I remember, I was talking about this earlier today, There was an Atlantic essay, The Atlantic, in like 2014, 2015, right around the time the Supreme Court gay marriage stuff was being litigated. And there was some essay where someone was comparing the gay marriage fight to the Selma, Alabama march, which, you know, is somewhere between abhorrent and just patently ridiculous. But the point here is that every person feels the need to strive for what they perceive to be justice. And when someone is saying that this fits into a broader worldview of injustice, we naturally gravitate toward that without necessarily thinking clearly here. So it gets rewarded with retweets, with likes, because people like to fit these idiosyncratic one-off things into a broader worldview, even if it's not a very good match. But look, you know, when I'm editing pieces in Newsweek, I am trying to intentionally use strong arguments, both in my own writing and my editing, but I like to avoid hyperbolic language that is designed simply for shock value, because that's not necessarily going to accomplish anything good, I think.
Yeah, I think that that's important, too, to sort of, like, what is the end goal here? Like, right. What are we trying to actually do? Is, are we trying to make people upset, or are we trying to actually inform them about the news?
Right.
So I wanted to move on from your Newsweek stuff to actually your panel here at TPUSA. One of the things that you talked about was the different conceptions of the term freedom, right? So there's the more libertarian view of freedom, which is I can do whatever I want as long as it doesn't hurt anybody, versus a more traditional kind of founder's vision of conservatism with restraints, and you live a life of virtue. I was wondering if you could sort of expand on that idea for our listeners and sort of come down on which you believe is the best way for conservatism to go.
Yeah, so it's funny. So my basic thesis here is that what we now call conservatism, or what we have called conservatism for a while now, is very, very libertarian in nature. There are parts of it that are kind of inherently conservative. Those are kind of like the more nationalist strands, the more kind of like immigration restrictionist strand. Like, there is some real conservative content there. But this notion that freedom is just the ability to kind of let every individual kind of maximize their full potential, it's the infamous mystery passage from Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the 1992 Supreme Court case where Anthony Kennedy and the abortion case is basically saying that the definition of freedom is to kind of like define your own existence about the mysteries of human life. This is kind of, it's a certain strand of Enlightenment liberalism taken to its real extreme logical conclusion here. But there is a differing view as to what freedom and liberty actually is here. The founders themselves disagreed about this. I mean, there were some kind of more like Enlightenment-centric thinkers among the founding generation. People like Thomas Jefferson was probably the chief proponent of that. He was a real Enlightenment guy for sure. But there's a totally different line of thought here. George Washington, John Adams, Alexander Hamilton, much more traditionalist in how they viewed kind of the relationship between human liberty and the powers of the state. I mean, in George Washington's first inaugural address, it's a beautiful, beautiful speech. He speaks quite eloquently about the imperative, if you actually want to make good in your community, in your nation, it starts in the home. It starts with building a family. It starts with private morality. The preamble of the Constitution itself, something I very frequently cite, it lists seven enumerated ends of governance for this American experiment that we also love. They are all kind of oriented towards justice, the common good, the blessings of liberty. By the way, that's not liberty as an end unto itself. It's the blessings of liberty that we're actually trying to pursue here. So the more traditional conception of freedom is basically that we will never actually be truly free unless we are living in constraints inherently oriented towards the common good, and then ultimately what our various religious traditions teach is the highest good, which is God.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely fascinating to look at the two conceptions of liberty and freedom that we have, obviously, in a post sort of like, traditional conservative post-Trump world as well. So one of the things that actually brings to mind is you did a really fascinating virtual event with the Notre Dame Young Republicans, where you talk about the origins of conservatism from sort of post-World War II Buckley, that sort of traditional school of conservatism, to the post-Trump period of New Fusionism. What do you think that New Fusionism and post-Trump conservatism looks like?
So, you know, the fusionist consensus, like when it kind of arose with William F. Buckley in the 50s, 60s, we have to remember it was kind of a time and a place, right? It was in reaction, of course, to the Cold War when the Soviet Union was literally an existential threat. We were trying to find a way to unite moral traditionalists, free marketeers, and national security hawks under one kind of partisan umbrella. Ronald Reagan obviously ultimately kind of was the culmination of that. But in the year 2021, we're facing some of the same problems, but a lot of different problems here. And, you know, my fellow conservatives, some of whom will just kind of thump their chest and say, you know, if it wasn't this way in the Reagan-Bush 1984 platform, I will never consider it. I'm strawmanning a little bit, but, like, there are some people who more or less kind of say that. That just can't be the way that we approach conservatives in the year 2021. We face totally different challenges. The rise of China, obviously, is the issue of all issues. It affects literally everything. Immigration, national security, our political economy, opioid epidemic in Ohio and the rest of it. It affects every issue. Immigration, identity politics, obviously this collusion between the government and big tech. We're just facing a different set of issues than kind of the Soviet Union and domestic inflation crises that, you know, that Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush face. So no one's really defined what a quote-unquote new fusion is necessarily is. In a different column, I referred to it as kind of the coalition of the unwoke. I kind of view the woke ideology, this intersectionality, identity politics, they're kind of all synonymous with one another. It's multiculturalism. I use these terms kind of interchangeably. This is effectively the new Marxism. In fact, my Edmund Burke Foundation colleague, Yoram Hazony, the president of the Edmund Burke Foundation, wrote a fabulous essay at Colette magazine last August, right around a year ago, called The Challenge of Marxism, where he basically kind of looked at the intellectual history and I thought quite definitively showed that this woke ideology, this authoritarian, substantively horrific woke ideology, is basically just Marxism without the economic element. It's the exact same thing. So some of the same paradigms are still there, but we're facing different issues and we have to be willing to adapt to them.
Sure. Actually, and on that note, I do think that that's an interesting point to make, is that there is a new threat. There is a new set of issues that conservatives have to face now. Back in the past, it would be the Soviets, it would be the USSR. Now, I'm actually curious, in your opinion, what is the biggest threat facing conservatism and what is the solution?
Well, the biggest threat facing the United States of America is the rise of communist China.
Okay.
I mean that is that's the geopolitical issue of the century, as far as I'm concerned. It literally stretches across everything we possibly do, right? I mean, corporate America obviously is in the tank for this. We obviously have all seen the LeBron James and the NBA and those guys are doing. But obviously, I mean, like Nike, Disney, or they're involved in Xinjiang. Just horrific. But look, I mean, Donald Trump, to his great credit, was the first president since Richard Nixon went to visit Mao Zedong in 1972 to actually challenge this bipartisan neoliberal consensus as applied to China. You know, the thought process was, if we open up China to the world, if we economically liberalize, they will politically liberalize. You know, the jury is in, and that failed. It just totally failed. The Chinese Communist Party today, you know, we're still not sure, obviously, how COVID started. It looks to me like it started in the lab. Whether they, like, intentionally bioengineered it is a different story. I'm not necessarily going to say that they did, but they might have. But this is a truly horrific authoritarian regime. And we need to, like, realize that our trade policy, our national security policy, our political economy, I mean, I agree with kind of a lot of this kind of like new intellectual thought into like kind of more industrial policy measures. Let's make ourselves more self-sufficient as far as critical supply chains are concerned. Let's get some semiconductors here so we're not reliant on the Asia-Pacific region for semiconductors. These are just some like common sense things that we should be thinking around, but a lot of it really is kind of downstream of China. Mm. On a domestic frontier, look, I personally view the rise of big tech as very similar to the rise of the late 19th century robber barons. I mean, Josh Hawley in his new book writes about this quite prolifically and at great length. But if you look at the New York Stock Exchange, the five largest market cap companies, let me see if I can do this. It's literally, it's Facebook, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and Apple. Not necessarily in that order, but those are literally the five. Those are the five largest. That's crazy. And like these companies, they control the current public square. They, for better or for worse, they literally do. And if they are effectively acting as kind of the ruling classes, what I refer to as the ruling classes, private sector enforcement arm, increasingly as it appears with Biden, they're acting as effectively just a de facto government adjunct of the actual state itself. We need to do something about that. That is not okay. And I think the time for people on the right to just like take a very hands-off approach to that, I think that ship has sailed. We've got to be willing to kind of get in there and take action on that front as well.
I think that's a very interesting point. So, unfortunately, we are running a little low on time, but I would like to give the last word to you. The way I try to end these interviews generally is to give the interviewee the last word. And what if somebody was to take only one thing from this interview, if they were to take the kernel of truth from this interview, what would it be? And then a little more specifically, if a young conservative was maybe listening to this, what should they keep in mind as they are going through their political journey?
Yeah, I love that. So on the first part of your question, I guess my parting message would be, from my perspective, there's been a big conflation on the American right in a lot of circles over the past 2, 3, 4, whatever decades, where we conflate enduring principle with idiosyncratic ad hoc policy. We have principles. I would recommend to the listeners' podcast, I mentioned him earlier, but my colleague Yoram Hazony wrote a fabulous essay in 2017 for American Affairs Journal, What is Conservatism? And he really kind of traces the intellectual history of conservatism. Would highly encourage that to the listeners. But the point here is that conservatism is a term that goes back to English common law, goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. Edmund Burke, obviously, William Blackstone, many of the great common lawyers. We have an idea what conservatism is, and it is a longer, more enduring, more intellectually robust tradition than, you know, necessarily being synonymous with whatever the Reagan-Bush 1984 platform is. So my parting message, I guess, would be to continually think about what conservatism is and get comfortable with the fact that there are enduring truths, there are enduring principles that our politics necessarily has to be oriented to pursuing. But because, like I often say, you know, we are, you got no time for this. I mean, like, the left is crazy. The left is unhinged like we've never seen them before. We are over 100 years into this Woodrow Wilson progressive, a crazy experiment, basically, distorting everything. If we want to save the Republic here, we've got to be very confident in our convictions and our principles, but maybe a little more pliant or flexible in the means. I would encourage that, you know, all the young listeners, the college students, just keep on thinking about that. Think about what we want to pursue, and then be a little more prudential, a little more pragmatic about the means to get there.
I think that's fantastic advice. That was Josh Hammer. Josh is the opinion editor and host of the debate podcast for Newsweek, a research fellow at the Edmund Burke Foundation, and as well as counsel and policy advisor for the Internet Accountability Project. Josh, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
The Daily Signal podcast is brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation. It is executive produced by Kate Trinko and Rachel Del Judas. Sound designed by Lauren Evans, Mark Guiney, and John Popp. For more information, visit dailysignal.com.